All right, well, joining our already current panelists up here are Michael O'Malley from Vasco and Doug Barbin from Brightline. Doug and Michael, since you guys are new to the panel, why don't you each spend a couple minutes telling us about your organizations and how their work is relevant to our topic, security and reliability.
Sure. I'm Michael O'Malley. I handle product marketing and business development for Vasco. We've taken about 20 years of technology in the banking security and authentication area, and we've seen an opportunity to move that into cloud infrastructure. Because one of the things we'll talk about in the process of this panel is as part of big data and infrastructure, there's a lot of discussion around security and physical security and standards-based security and things like that. But there's also an important piece that we think that's missing, and that's around user authentication and security. And if we look at a lot of these different processes, it's really the user interface or the user access to this content right now, that's the weak link in the security process, and that's what we're trying to fix.
Thanks. And Doug?
Great. My name's Doug Barbin. I'm a partner with Brightline CPAs. Probably not a household name for most of you, but if anyone's done any deep looking at cloud provider assurance, compliance, certification, it wouldn't take you long to come across our name. We work with about 350 different clients, many of which some of the leading cloud providers that are out there. We're actually the only firm in the world that can do, it's a licensed CPA firm that does the SOC reports, has been alluded to in one of the past presentations, ISO 27001 certification, PCI validation, and now FedRAMP authorization for federal cloud computing. So we do that in the midst of HIPAA and a variety of other things. So our mission is very simple. We're not a consulting firm. We can't be a consulting firm because of ISO. So we try to be a one-stop shop. If people have, cloud providers in particular, have needs to go through multiple types of audits for their customers, we can come in once, do a set of procedures, and issue multiple reports. That's basically us. I've been with the firm for about 4 years now. A little bit of a unique perspective because I haven't been in this industry my whole life. Prior to this, I was a head of product management for VeriSign's managed security services business. So in that perspective, I was the auditee. And spent about 10 years at VeriSign there, consulting a variety of other roles within the security organization.
Thanks, Doug. First question, I guess we'll start with Brian. He's immediately to my left.
All right.
What did you hear in the keynotes presented by the other speakers regarding cloud computing, big data, infrastructure, analytic programs, or cloud billing that raises the greatest concerns for security or reliability, and where is the most serious threat?
I'm not going to pick on my own presentation, I don't think. No, I mean, I think it was pretty telling when you look at the security aspects. There's external auditors that come in and take a look at from a compliance perspective with SSIE and your PCI compliance. So I think that's all pretty well understood. I actually believe that somebody put up, I think, one of the slides that showed security breaches across the enterprises today. Most of those are not cloud driven. That's all coming out of your own IT shops. So being a former Sun employee, I think there is some advantage to taking care of and leveraging the cloud environment. And I do think that it is actually more secure than a lot of IT shops, especially when you drive down to the SMB marketplace. So from my perspective, I think I would just start with that premise and pass along to the other panelists.
Jason?
I would probably agree with Brian on that too. I think, again, this small and medium enterprise doesn't have that many security specialists on staff. So for them to design security and solutions, it's tough. It's the authentication and IDM side is really interesting as well here. So I know Sun bought at least two of them, and mm-hmm. I think Oracle had two as well. So big space. I know we just invested almost $1 million in redesigning our entire authentication platform because it's so important to all of our customers, because it is really that linkage into the data itself.
Tom?
Yeah, I would tend to agree that especially with the more significant growth of cloud among SMBs right now, that more times than not, it's significantly more secure. I think in the enterprises, it may be the case, but I think the level of paranoia is much higher. I think the in any time there's a minor breach or a minor blip in a public cloud environment, it puts that whole industry on notice. But you know, that's over a period of time, that's kind of resolving itself as folks get more experience. I think there are a couple of new areas that many of the enterprises are grappling with, and one of them is locality. You know, I think the industry, the cloud, the public cloud side of it, and the hosters in particular, have not done a good enough job of explaining the enterprises exactly what the strategies are to make sure that they're compliant with the requirements to make sure your data is in one country or another. You know, certainly some of the, so that will be top, front and center in the news now over the next few weeks. But I think locality is probably the one aspect of, maybe not security, but compliance that that has not been fully dealt with, in my opinion.
Thanks, Tom. Vic?
So when Master Control thinks about security, thinks about interacting with, you know, via West and cloud providers, as well as being a service provider of cloud, this is a pattern that we've really already seen before outside of technology, and maybe even within technology, but it's just general outsourcing. So when you go out and you look at a service provider, at the end of the day, it's still incumbent upon you to make sure that your data is secure, that you trust the service provider that you're going with. So, you know, when you look at the business model for cloud, really what it boils down to is, you know, we make an initial investment. We have to have a sufficient number of customers that vote for us and say, hey, we're going to use you. And then what we're able to do is provide a higher service level than those people would have been able to provide themselves. So, I mean, I would really just echo the sentiment that, you know, look at your own IT staffs. How often does Outlook go down? How often does a server go down? When's the last time that Facebook just stopped working, right? When's the last time that Salesforce wasn't working? And then, the interesting that I think about as well is, you know, I mentioned LinkedIn. LinkedIn lost my password. And there's a lot of angst about, you know, what's security, what's gonna happen. But there's been use cases where security breaches happen and very large cloud providers recover. So, if you're a service provider or a consumer, you know, really just look at it as a vendor selection decision. And that's how we approach it.
Michael?
Sure. So from our perspective, first of all, thrilled to hear that, authentication and identity management is getting more attention. And certainly if you're reviewing your procedures, for God's sake, let's talk after this panel. But from our perspective, big data isn't new, right? There's a great book that I'm reading right now that will seem totally unrelated to this panel, but trust me, give me 30 seconds and that'll start to make sense. And that is Bletchley Park, the guys that broke the Enigma code during World War II in the UK. Right? This was big data of 1939, and it was a room full of people basically, you know, taking all the German codes, decrypting them, then translating them from German into English, and then filing these things under, you know, the forerunner of metadata, which were admins going through the message and writing down what general was being talked about and what were the locations and put into some giant file cabinet, right? And based on all that, they had decrypted all the German codes, all the Japanese codes, and the big decision for Churchill at the time was, do I tell Roosevelt, do I tell the Americans that we're listening in on all this German traffic, right? And ultimately he decided not to, and there's all sorts of conjecture of did he do it to get the US into the war, but fundamentally they believe that he didn't do it because he fundamentally didn't trust that if he told people the value of this big data that he had, that word would go back to the Germans, they'd change the codes, and then they'd have to go through all this big data work again, right? And so our fundamental belief is that a lot of these systems that people are building, they're ignoring the front door being the user interface, right? There's all sorts of stuff being done today with ISO, with PCI, all of these different standards and compliance groups. But as we all know, standards and compliance groups are around what's the minimal set of things we can all agree to that are best practices, right? It's not the best, it's not the best in the world of what could be done. It's not even what is state of the art, but it's what can we all agree to. And we think that the user interface and authentication and static passwords and how I get into the data is the most vulnerable piece, right? And I agree completely with the slide that was in the ViaWest presentation saying something like 98%, I think it was, of all companies have had their data hacked, right? And much of it is through static login password because it's the easiest way to get in, right? And we've seen lots of CIOs that say, listen, there's only two choices here, and the two choices are, have I been hacked and I know it, or have I been hacked and I don't even know it, right? And that's, I think, really what we're talking about here, and what we're trying to do is to close that front door and handle that security to give the trust for big data to really deliver what we think it's capable of.
Thanks, Mike. Jason?
Oh, sorry, Doug.
Sorry. So I was going to touch on a point just a little different from what was brought up here, because I agree with most everything that was said there. But one of the concepts that came up in multiple presentations was this concept of hybrid cloud and clouds talking to other clouds, inter-cloud connections and so forth. And we see that a lot in the work that we do. I'm not 100% sure, Jason, on how ViaWest is organized. Some data center operators own their own buildings. Some of them exist within a digital realty trust or some other type of building. You've got companies that have, managed hosting providers working within data centers. There could be three or four different organizations that are tasked with providing your cloud. And so that can be a great thing from an availability perspective, from a redundancy, from a getting back online. I saw over this weekend, of course, the Terramark Verizon getting some flack for what happened with healthcare.gov. My immediate question wasn't shame on Verizon. It was, well, why weren't they failing over to another location, another telco, and so forth? So there's not a lot of advantages to it, but from a security and a compliance perspective, you really have to understand the roles and responsibilities. Who is responsible for what during what instance, and when bad things happen, who's responsible for stepping in and taking up? And because you can create gaps when there's too many cooks in the kitchen. So.
Thanks, Doug. We'll start with Jason for the next question. What did you hear in the keynotes with other speakers or in the answers we just heard about security or reliability with which you most disagree and why? And which perceived threat may or may not be real and why?
Good question. So maybe to make a sort of grand statement, I think that the challenge maybe in the IT world at this point is security is really built on trust, right? And a lot of the technologies we've used in the last 10 or 15 years, Diffie-Hellman, RSA, the stuff that SSL is built into, with the whole NSA discovery that there's back doors in a lot of the security technologies that we use today, it does sort of make you wonder, I guess, what is really secure today in the space that we're in. And so I think there's a lot more room for improvement. And I know Vic Winkler, I don't see him here, but he talked about that in his talk in his book. The whole concept of what was digital rights management is something that really needs to be applied to data as a whole, because it's a company's data, it's a person's data. I, as a cloud hoster, and I 98% of my facilities I either own or lease. I don't really operate within somebody else's space. But I, as an owner of that data, want to make sure that a cloud provider can't run errant with that data, right? I want to know when you've really cleared it out of your system. I want to know when you've really destroyed it. I want to know that you don't have a copy somewhere. So I think there's a lot of work that can happen within the industry to really start putting some DRM capabilities around the precipitous stuff that we generate every single day and really build a model around that, which I think links into Vasco's vision as well.
Tom?
Yeah, I would say, we're talking about a number of topics. We're talking about security and we're talking about reliability and resiliency. And you made the comment, when does Facebook go down? And I think that's an important question, right? Because there's a wide degree of variability across models like Facebook or Google and many of the public cloud providers that are building out massively scalable infrastructure on what is effectively hyperscale, commodity components. I mean, this is one of the things that I think if you take a step back and look at it, is a big difference between an on-premise or an on-premise private cloud and what some, not all, hosters and public clouds can do. You've got, you know, decades of experience in how do you do, run a data center in five or six nines. You've got decades of experience in terms of how do I deal with all kinds of recovery scenarios, everything from a backup fail to I have a smoking hole that used to be my building. And those are real things, not just from a, you know, compliance standpoint. There are real things that companies have to deal with, and they deal with them, it seems like, more and more and more. I mean, you had, you know, the hurricane there on the East Coast in the last year. You know, I had a customer there that was using a hybrid cloud. They were using on-premise technology, they're using private cloud technology, and they had it all backed up to an outfit called Atos that does all the disaster recovery. Well, guess what? Where's their data center? It's in the upper floors. Guess where all the electrical stuff is? It's in the basement. Basement was located on Water Street in New York, and it was appropriately named because the basement was full to about six levels below the street level. We had a floods up in Calgary, I think it was, over the last month or so. Same exact scenario, flooding. And, you know, that is a disaster recovery scenario. And there's two sides to that equation. One is, if I'm using a hybrid cloud, or I'm backing up to a cloud, or I'm bursting, you know, maybe there's a recovery benefit to that. And the other is, what if my cloud provider was the guy with all the electrical stuff in the basement? So it can go down. And not all, in my experience, not all hosters, not all public clouds have really thought deeply about resiliency. And I'll say the one other thing is that's related to resiliency is quality of service. Yeah, it may not go down, but is it operating optimally for the applications that you have? And I think one of the things enterprises are figuring out is that there's a lot of variability across those two dimensions. And I think somebody said, you know, think about it as vendor selection, right? That's all it is. Make sure you really understand how they're backing my stuff up. Make sure you really understand, you know, am I going to get it back in under a second or is it going to be 10 seconds? I mean, those are classic data center issues that you just have to apply to this cloud environment. So that was a little long, but that's I think, a big topic.
Still informative. Thanks, Tom. Vic?
So I think I'm going to take a little... I think Tom did a wonderful job explaining, you know, that component of it. I want to take a different crack at it, and that's on GRC. So Master Control, we service a lot of pharma med dev clients, and we see from a GRC perspective that there's this reticence that's separate from security, but goes hand in hand with how do you make that cloud vendor selection? And the one thing that I want to point out is what's driving this? Why do people care? So from our perspective, it's this huge specialization. So what we're enabled to do is, rather than each one of our customers having an IT guy with a pager on, that, you know, the pager goes off at 2 a.m. once a week, and, you know, he's pulling out his hair, we're tasked with that job, and we do a really, really wonderful job of it because we're supporting folks in India, we're supporting folks here in the States, we're getting great server utilization, our virtuals are constantly being utilized. So the value prop for the product is driving interest. Well, then you get pushback from either GRC or security, and really what that's creating is specialization. I think that's one of the things you pointed out was the specialization is really shifting. So because the economies of scale are there, because we can spin up environments at a much lower cost, because, you know, the CapEx investment's out of your hands, what it's doing is it's creating this whole new layer of specialization that, you know, has been around for some time, but I think really is, you know, just as of recent, really starting to hit its stride to where people are just, you know, it's a no-brainer. I assume my data is going to be as secure within your cloud as it would be on-premise. That's just one crack on it on GRC.
Thanks, Vic.
Mike?
I would probably piggyback onto the billing and subscription model that was discussed in the Oracle presentation, which I thought was really good. And say to that, I think the other piece that we should add to that to talk about is subscription sharing, right? Which is a significant, absolutely you have to get the billing and the back end figured out, but subscription sharing is a serious problem. And, you know, I saw data from a poll that was done in the spring saying that in the U.S., they believe that about one-third of all subscriptions are shared. And Mikey and I talked about it at one of the breaks for Netflix. You know, there was a big article in Netflix in the New York Times in the spring by one of the reporters saying that they met with three other friends at a coffee shop in New York City. They were all going to home to stream Game of Thrones on Netflix, and none of the four of them were going to stream it with a subscription they paid for. Now, I know Mike and I talked about this, and Netflix, you know, has a little bit of a different model where, you know, they're okay with a certain amount of sharing. But I would argue that generally speaking, you know, subscription sharing within the industry is certainly a revenue drain, and is something that people want to take care of. And there's definitely an opportunity there with regard to authentication and understanding your user base to increase your revenues. If a third of people are sharing subscriptions, to increase your revenues up to 33%, right? And if I can do it in a way that's secure and easy for my users to manage, why wouldn't I want to do that?
Great point. Doug?
Okay. So, all right, so the piece I disagree with that was brought up, there's been, you know, quite a few statements made that, you know, that the cloud providers are probably more secure than enterprise IT is currently. I would probably disagree with that statement. I would also disagree with the statement that enterprise IT is any more secure. I'd strongly make the argument that any use of cloud, any combination, permutation use of cloud that you have, requires you to be an active customer. And that's what we continue to see. What scares me the most is when companies sign up for a service because it's sold to them as being a secure service or being a reliable service, but they didn't take the time to understand, to take the next, not go all the way down to the details to start debating crypto algorithms, but to say, okay, you're multi-tenant, you have access control, how are you doing that? Is it just username and password? Is it something more advanced with that? I've got a startup client that does log analysis in the cloud, and each one of their customers has their own, has their own encryption key. So it's username and password, and it's key management. So I think it requires that, one, you have to be an active customer. You can't just buy something and assume it's secure or not secure. Maybe you should assume it's not secure, but be an active customer in terms of how it's configured. Amazon, as a joke, kind of forces you to do that, right? They don't really, you really have to configure everything yourself if you're buying an instance on Amazon. So I think those would be the major two things to try to get past the cloud secure, cloud's not secure types of arguments. When you're talking about vendor selection, as was mentioned, get down to the next layer of granularity and understand, okay, how is security being done? So.
Thanks. We'll finish up with Brian with this question.
Yeah, so maybe just to add more on the reliability aspect, I think there's multiple phases when we look at that. Certainly you need a strong infrastructure as a service to build it. What we see in the marketplace is moving up into building a strong platform as a service up through your application tier and your application layer. And we've gone down the engineered systems route, and we believe that you can get a lot of reliability, a lot of fine tuning out of that. From a reliability perspective, I think you have to look at a automated process. And this is really from order to cache all the way through it. So it's not just in the data center, but how are you doing your processes on top of that? From a customer all the way through them ordering through delivery of that product and service. Is it automated or are you doing manual workarounds? And we see a lot of that in today's marketplace. And the final one really comes from the network side. So how are you designing that network from a bandwidth perspective? Is bandwidth there? Is it redundant out from your provider? Are you leveraging a quality of service? Can you integrate a quality of service? I deal a lot with the operators, Verizon's and Sprint's and AT&T's, British Telecom's, all of those folks. They're getting squeezed. Data's going crazy at 26 times. Their revenues are flat and declining. Over the top providers are making the money. So they're trying to figure out how do they get revenue out of their bandwidth. And some of our SaaS providers or over the top providers are trying to figure out, how do I improve my customer experience? So we see a marriage being made between a quality of service and maybe paying a little bit more for that. I know personally, if I'm sitting down to download a movie and I have my kids waiting there, I'll pay a little extra something for it. So.
Thanks, Brian. All right, our last question, and we'll start with Tom for this one. What can mobile cloud computing and big data end users or providers or of solutions or each of these groups do together to mitigate the bona fide security and reliability concerns? In other words, how do we fix the proverbial problem?
Well, I think one of the challenges that we're all wrestling with is at the use case level. And I think that, you know, one of the things to consider is that the use cases of a school district with 2,000 students and teachers or 5,000 students and teachers from a security standpoint are very, very different than the security issues of Goldman Sachs. And so I think that one of the big trends that we're seeing, and I know this is not a technology answer, but one of the big trends we're seeing is more and more customers wanting to have a discussion about workloads and use cases, and maybe a little less, frankly, about is it cloud or is it not cloud. And so from an HP standpoint, in all candor, and I don't know if Oracle's terribly different, we come from a legacy of selling very homogeneous offerings that whether you're big, small, or somewhere in the middle, the answer is going to be a server plugged into a network with a storage device on it. And I think we're seeing a big change in the industry right now towards designed solutions, or use the term engineered solutions, or specific use case orientation that is designed to solve a segment of an industry really, really well. And I think the place that that comes together is in the hands of system integrators and resellers. And, you know, there are lots and lots of them out there, but the smart ones are the ones that are basically saying, look, I'm going to focus on state and local, education, government, and I'm going to craft a solution that's going to go from end to end, from a mobile device, thin client, all the way through the network security, all the way through the accelerators that I need all the on the network, all the way to the appliance solution on the back end. So I think that the my sense of it is the best way, the technology all exists, the best way to kind of work together is to figure out how you get a combination of, it might be Oracle and HP technology, into the hands of integrators that are crafting workload-based or segment-specific offerings that are designed, you know, designed for use cases in particular segments. I think the technology's there. I think it's more a question of how you target the offering of the particular needs of the workload and the user.
Thanks, Tom. Vic?
So one aspect of it that I think that, so I don't know so much if I have an answer as much as another question. When you look at the barrier to entry to software development and product to market for software technology, because of the cloud, that barrier to entry is getting lower and lower. So what we see is we see more highly competitive point solutions that encroach at the low end. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with disruptive technology or Clayton Christensen, but what we're really seeing is the cloud is enabling software technology to get to SMEs at a very, very reasonable price. So one of the things that we're thinking about and we're trying to wrap our heads around is if product becomes more and more specialized, how do we maintain integration? And you know, one of the things that we see is around authentication, you see password players, right? So everybody uses Google authentication. So many people use Facebook authentication. You know, are you going to connect to your Active Directory? Are you going to use SAML? Are you going to use LDAP? You know, as we get more and more and more specialized, what's going to happen is there's going to be this issue of, all right, I got these wonderful, perfect, you know, point solution apps, and I've sort of moved away from, you know, the big ERP system and MRP system that did everything to these more focused applications. How am I going to integrate those, and how am I going to secure those across the board? So that's one of the things that I'm waiting for, you know, the market sort of react to is, you know, we start partnering with other vendors and combining our data.
Thanks, Vic. Mike?
I think from my perspective, from a security viewpoint, you know, there's a lot of discussion with regard, and we've had a fair amount of it here, with regard to reliability and redundancy. And I would agree with the panel saying that, you know, whether I'm looking at optical networking or MPLS or whatever the technology may be, those technologies all exist, can be leveraged. It's about asking the right questions. And there's also a lot of discussion then about infrastructure security, distributed denial of service attacks, all those other pieces. Again, well known, well understood, there's technologies available to do that. You know, from our perspective, from a VASCO perspective, there needs to be more consideration, as we've mentioned, on the identity and authentication part of this, and that's really based on just what's been in the news in the last 6 months. If I look at the most recent example, that's Adobe, which I'm sure many of you have heard of, about having their records accessed and a lot of customer records now put out into OpenView and were breached. AP Twitter, just a few months before, again hacked in through login and password. Prior to that, Amazon Zappos has a lawsuit now. The last I checked, it was seven lost shareholder lawsuits, claiming that they didn't do enough to protect user information. So I think it's really around, in addition to doing all these other security measures, it's around closing the front door, and that front door is the login and password, or how I'm managing identity management and authentication.
Thanks, Mike. Doug?
Yeah, I completely agree with Mike and Victor, what you brought up as well, except that I'd probably disagree and say that most aren't using Google Auth or Facebook Auth. My wife is forced to do it, and she complains every time she's gotta go through it. SAML is, SAML may be available a lot, but it's not forced in many cases. And so I think going back to the problem with user awareness, the other thing technology companies can do is, PCI and HIPAA and a variety of other compliance requirements require you to have a security awareness program for your own people, for your own internal staff. Nothing really requires you to have a security awareness program for your users. Yeah. So I'd love to see cloud providers have more, videos, articles, quarterly newsletters, security tips for using the cloud services to do crazy things, such as maybe you get a discount if you force SAML, you force Google authentication, or you create some different classes of service where they get some additional benefits that the general population that uses a username and password doesn't. Really try to change the game from a monetary perspective if that's possible, and if not, just more of a media and awareness perspective to try to get these issues, because you're right, it's the same ones that come back, that come back over and over again. You don't want to say, bad user. I mean, it is to a certain degree, but the users, it's debatable whether or not the users have the right tools and are aware of the right tools and incentivized to use the right tools to really lock down these apps. Yeah. So.
Well, Doug, one of the thoughts that I had was, I don't know if that's so much a cloud-related problem. When I was implementing business systems, I used to walk around my office, everything was on-prem, and I would see post-it notes with passwords. And that was a function of multiple authentication for multiple products,
yep.
Right? So at least from my perspective, when we evaluate that problem, we think about it, what we really see is just that thing reemerging. So what happened was you had all these different disparate applications, Active Directory, LDAP came along, one username, one password. So I think you hit the nail on the head, and I totally agree with you that in this cloud environment where you have multiple service providers all asking for their own user authentication,
yep.
How are you gonna reconcile that, and what is gonna be the product that reconciles that? So I think you're right on in terms of how is that going
to
be handled?
Man, they're starting to come out too. You're starting to see, Okta and several, so there's that's
ping
becoming
identity.
A very there's yeah, ping identity. It's become a very competitive space because people, one, are dealing with all the cloud authentication issues, and two, they don't like having to remember all those passwords, so they do the same thing, that most do, write them down somewhere and pretend that they're secure. So.
And I think the other comment to make there is I agree with you. It's the same problem coming back. But it's coming back. This is like the flu virus that now comes back in a more virulent form, right? This is the flu coming back much more virulent this time because of the concentration of data in the cloud,
right?
Because so much more data and so much more information is there. If I can get to those goodies and break in, it's got 20 times, 50 times, 100 times the value of what it had when it was all siloed on-prem in 500 different organizations.
Yeah, so I think back in the Sun days, we had a project called Project Liberty. And so it was more single sign-on oriented. I think another interesting aspect is I talk with a lot of the operators, CSPs around, and the concept around OAuth and being a trusted authorization provider. So who would you trust with that?
Right.
You know, back in the day, Liberty was kind of a Scott McNeely thing that came out of a Microsoft wanting to hold everybody's password. Right. And that didn't go over too well with a lot of folks. And but OAuth is something that's a big topic in the CSP community today and should be looked at.
Yeah, we'll finish with Jason.
I do remember we were working for AT&T Wireless and for a project, and we thought that AT&T would provide all the services we would ever need, and that would be okay because they had our social security number. So they knew everything about us already. So it was, I think until we can figure out what the mental model and how you connect the brain in terms of figuring out what intent is, I think the security idea of, you know, how do you train your users?
Yeah.
I just know from Amazon, you know, I use it, my wife uses it, so I get these recommendations that aren't for me. Yeah. But, I mean, there's a sense of intent, like, you know, who am I really? How do you go figure out that pattern, which, you know, you'd think you'd be able to solve from a big data analytics perspective someday. But right. I don't know if you've ever heard of a company called Biometric Signature. They've actually got a signature algorithm that they use for their authentication platform. And a big use case is in education where, and I didn't really think about this before, but very easy for somebody in to go in and take a test as you, right? They might look at your photograph, but they don't really pay that much attention. This guarantees that it's you because there's no way that you'd be able to sign the same way as that person. So, I mean, it's really changed their fraud fraud program there.
Absolutely. Can that go across devices as well?
Yeah,
so devices, I mean, I do web, Square and yeah. I sign my name. Yeah. I do it on a mobile device. I can do it at my desktop, my laptop, where have you.
Except for the small problem that they don't teach cursive in the schools
anymore.
That's
right. There is that. I know when I tried to train it the first time, it was hard. That's a good point.
Small problem.
Good point.
Yeah, but they don't teach any type of handwriting, so it's all uniquely.
That's just it. It's going to be swipes on a keypad, right?
I agree.
But I know it's yeah. As soon as I put in multi-factor authentication on our cloud platform, I had all these people complaining that it was too complicated, right? So, I mean, always the combination is like, how do you get people to use it and not turn it off and not try to write around it?
Sure. I mean, the way we've approached that is to really try to focus on the ease of use piece with regard to multi-factor authentication, right? And that's through partner programs where we're embedding our technology into Intel Silicon so that you register your computer with you as the user and it acknowledges you. And then the other way is, as we said before, right, this is my smartphone's the most personal device I have, right? Nobody uses this, including my wife, right? She's got her own. And so, you know, using the smartphone then as a device then to do something as simple as snap QR codes, right, and using that because the IMEI of this mobile device has registered me. Another way to do that and kind of lower those barriers to entry and make it easier for the user.
Well, we're definitely way over time, but does anyone have any last questions, comments, or anything for our specific panelists or entire panel as a whole? Going once? Going twice?
They held up the 1 minute card. That's it.
Let's have one last round of applause for every one of our panel members.